Welcome to this, the last in our series of podcasts celebrating the Spectator's Economic Disruptor of the Year Awards, sponsored by Julius Baer, the private bank. Today we are talking about the entries for the awards that have come from Birmingham and the Midlands, a region we've stretched slightly to include Cambridge in the case of one entrant. I'm Martin van der Weer. I'm the business editor of the Spectator and its Any Other Business columnist. And I've got two guests with me today. I've got John Cordwell, a legendary British entrepreneur in the mobile phone business, now turned investor and philanthropist. He is a son of Birmingham and Stoke-on-Trent, and we'll talk to him about his own life in entrepreneurship and disruption in a moment. And Mark Embley, who is the regional manager of Julius Baer, based in Birmingham. So, John, if I can come to you first, in brief, I know that you started out as an apprentice in the motor trade, obviously a great feature of the industrial life of the Midlands, and then in the mid-80s you saw the opportunity of mobile phones. 1987, I think, you launched what became Phones for You. That became one of the leaders of that sector in this country. You sold that business, having, I think, as you just told us, sold some 70 million mobile phones. And since then, you've been doing all sorts of other things, including a lot of very good work in the philanthropic field for disease treatment for children, Lyme's disease, and so on. And I know you're also involved in some big property development work in London now. But what I wanted to ask you is, when you started out in the mobile phone business in the mid-80s, did the concept of disruptor, was that something you ever talked about? Did you think you were a disruptor? What does disruptor mean to you in your own life story?
Well, that's a good question. I'll come on to that in a second, but I'd just like to just cover a couple of points first, which is the first one was, I really like the idea of being legendary, except that it's better if I'm legendary in my own lifetime, since the definition of legendary means you're dead. But anyway, I'm still partially alive today, so that's a good thing. And your description of apprentice in the motor trade, it was very, very loose because I was Michelin Tyre Company, so we were making tyres for the motor trade. But
were you actually technically an apprentice?
I was an apprentice. I was an engineering apprentice for Michelin Tyre Company. And that was actually a really, really great foundation to my career, really. And not that I thought it was at the time, because we spent hours filing metal blocks with blunt files and turning lathes and welding things. And, you know, I did all of that. And of course, I could still do it today, so that's quite a nice skill to have. But I'm not called for very often on that level.
So was there a moment when you thought, no, this isn't for me, I want to be an entrepreneur?
Oh, no, I always wanted to be from the age of seven. From the age of seven, I didn't know entrepreneur, I didn't know what it meant, but I wanted to be successful and wealthy and entrepreneurial. And my vision of that, in a very naive, young, childish way, was sitting in the back of a chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce handing £5 notes out to poor people. And that was my vision. And of course, as I got older, my vision began to be a little bit more sophisticated than that naive interpretation of where I wanted to get. The success, I started to understand what it meant to be successful. I started to understand what wealth meant, and I started to understand what philanthropy meant. So that sort of burden, if you like, because it was a burden, that burden stayed with me throughout my entire teenage years and early 20s. And I had no inspiration from anybody and no connections, no network, nothing to inspire me to get there. So it was a burden because I had no idea I was going to succeed. I could talk about my early life, but we can go on to answer the question
The key part of the question was really about the idea of disruption.
Disruption, yeah.
Whether that's a concept that meant anything when you were getting going in the second half of the 80s.
I think I've always been a disruptor without even being able to pronounce the word. I think long before I heard the word disruptor, and I can remember the person who first mentioned it, it was the chief executive of Motorola, who said, "We are going to disrupt the market." And I remember those words, and this was probably in 1990-something, and thinking, that's a combination of exciting and frightening. I wonder what he means. But actually, when I look back, I was a disruptor all the time. I disrupted the market, changed the market continually and endlessly to create value for my businesses and give the customers better service and better value. And in that process, disrupted prices, disrupted strategies, disrupted a lot of things, really. So I did become very aware of the word disruptor.
And who were you up against at that point? Who were your first set of competitors? And were you the small fry against big competitors?
Well, certainly when I started out, I was a small fry because all the mobile phone companies had come from Band 4 and from PMR, mobile radio, and they'd already got a wealth of experience at selling mobile products. And I came in from nowhere and had to start learning the ropes. And I always remember the first competition I won, which was with a Motorola competition, which was to go for a weekend away in a lovely spa resort down in the south of England. And they gave me a target, and I beat the target and ended up on this trip. When people on the trip asked me what I'd done to beat my target, I said I'd sold two Motorola car kits instead of one. Just the car kit. It was staggering, you know, I mean, just two car kits. Some of those people had sold 10 or 20 phones to get on that trip. I had sold two car kits and no phones. But, you know, what was fascinating in those days for me was that I came into the business knowing nothing and met these people who I had a drink with and all these competitors who I had a drink with, and we sat in the hot tubs and chatted together, became friendly. What I realised was that they weren't very smart, because all I had to do was flatter them and they gave me all their secrets away. So these trips became invaluable for me to find out discount prices I could get, where the best deals were, how to market the product and so on and so forth. And they hadn't got the overall, they hadn't got a complete answer, of course, but what they did was sparked off thoughts in my head that allowed me to grow my business. And from that moment on, we just grew and grew and grew, and those competitors eventually became customers of mine or actually ceased to exist.
Did you have, at that stage, did you find either a mentor or someone who really made a difference in helping you build the business? And maybe different question, do you now have a sort of entrepreneur hero, someone you looked up to as a model?
I never had a mentor. I don't really have any entrepreneurial heroes, no. I respect and admire individuals, regardless of whether they're at the bottom of the food chain or at the top, that make a big difference to the world. You know, and there's some people that you meet that just give their lives away for other people. And I think it's very inspirational when people are so selfless and they do a huge amount of good for the world without necessarily getting anything back, and sometimes not even thanks. And that's what inspires me and what gives me great admiration.
It's a marvellous image of you as a young man or even as a boy, picturing yourself in the back of a Rolls Royce giving out £5 notes to the poor, which suggests that the idea of the philanthropy came along at the same time as the idea of entrepreneurship in your mind. Is that right? Right from
the start? No, absolutely. It was at the same time. It was a strange vision, because my father had told me that a Rolls Royce was the best car in the world and the most expensive. So I think my boyhood dream was to have that Rolls Royce. I don't know where the philanthropy came from, I'm not sure. But of course, I didn't see it as philanthropy. I didn't know what that meant. I knew that it would be wonderful if I could have this dream car with a chauffeur, and I could just go around the streets winding my window down or electrically lowering them and handing these £5 notes out. And it just felt like a fantastic thing to do. So of course, those early visions had to become a lot more mature to get me to where I eventually arrived at.
So let's turn to Mark Embley of Julius Baer in Birmingham. Mark, first of all, just very briefly introduce your business to us in Birmingham.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Martin. Julius Baer, as you've mentioned earlier, is a private bank that originally started as a family business 125 years ago and only listing as a public company relatively recent. And those sort of family entrepreneurial roots still exist very much today in the pioneering ethos of the business that only does one thing, and that is managing wealth. And my role in the business is to work with individuals, families, and in particular entrepreneurs, to understand their priorities and objectives and help them to achieve those.
Good. Well, I'm going to ask you, Mark, if you would, to just in a couple of sentences introduce each of the three finalists from the region that we're going to talk about. They are, in alphabetical order, Black Pear Software, based in Worcester, which is in the healthcare sector, Speechmatics, based in Cambridge, which is in speech recognition, and Warwick Music, actually based in Tamworth, which makes plastic musical instruments. But just say a word or two about Let's start with Black Pear Software, shall we?
Of course, yeah. Black Pear Software, as you say, based in Worcester, has created a software solution enabling NHS clinicians to pull together patient data from the multiple platforms that are used by the NHS, leading to more efficient and accurate patient care. And they do this using public cloud service in the UK, something that hasn't been done before, and they have achieved something that many have tried in the past to do and have failed.
Okay, and I just want to say that this is one of actually two finalists in a rather similar territory. So Evergreen Life, which was in our Northwestern regional podcast, is also in this area of basically apps to make life easier for NHS patients and doctors. And that we had quite a number of other NHS-related entries in the competition. So in the London region, there's one which is making it much easier to handle repeat prescriptions. That one's called Echo. We had several which were simply about making it easier to get a doctor's appointment with a GP or a specialist and so on. So the impression is there's a lot of disruptive possibilities in the NHS because of the nature of the NHS, its size, its bureaucracy, its burden that it carries, its cost pressures and so on. John, in a general sense, you do a lot of your philanthropic work is related to healthcare, I know. What's your observation about the possibilities of disruption in the NHS? And what were your thoughts about this one particularly?
Well, I agree entirely about the disruptive possibilities within the NHS because it's such a huge, huge beast steeped in old traditions and old methodologies. And it really does need a huge amount of disruption. Disruption in the NHS is really difficult, though, because anything that you do could feasibly affect a patient's life negatively. And once there's anything that happens negatively to a patient, then you're really, really in trouble. It's a very, very difficult political area. So I think people have often said to me they'd love me to take over the NHS. And I thought, what a poison chalice. You know, on the one hand, I relish the opportunity because there's so much could be done. But you've only got to have an illness or a death that isn't even attributed to you or shouldn't be attributed to you, but could be. And you've got this huge political battle to fight. So I don't think it's a challenge I'll ever take up, even if offered. This particular company, I think, I don't know about competitors, but I do think it's a very, very positive thing for patients to be able to have their own records stored in the cloud and to be able to access them instantaneously. It's ideal if they see specialists who ask about the medical history and they've got the medical history there. It's ideal for themselves to be able to review drugs that they've taken in the past, inoculations that they've had in the past, the whole range of things to be able to be in control of their own medical care a little bit more and to be able to see what's happening. So I think the disruptive possibilities there are endless. But as you already said, there's competitors in the marketplace. So who's going to win this one? That's another question. But I think there is definitely a need for this to be implemented in the NHS and become standard procedure that every patient's information is available to them on a cloud-like app.
I remember lying in a hospital bed about 4 or 5 years ago, watching the nurses periodically scribbling data about me on clipboards and wondering whether it ever got into the computer and thinking, why don't they just buy some software like parcel tracking software from DHL or something? You know, sometimes you observe in the NHS, it's so archaic. I mean, it's so full of good people doing their absolute best, but the systems they're coping with are so unconnected and seem almost decades behind. So this one where it says, for example, it can draw data from several different systems within the NHS, have one doctor see them all, and then the doctor can report, and his report would or her report would go back to all the points he got the data from. It seems like a big step forward.
Yeah, I think it's an absolute must. It will happen, without doubt it will happen. It's just a matter of which company is going to be the one to make it happen.
Yeah. So that's that one. As I say, we've got a number in that field to look at, but it's doing very, very interesting work. So the next one, in a very different but highly advanced technical field, is Speechmatics. Mark, a brief summary, if you would.
Yeah, of course. Speechmatics, based in Cambridge, is a speech technology and automatic speech recognition business that's created a global speech engine with leading language coverage, high accuracy, and live speech-to-text capabilities. If you were to ask Siri or Alexa, they will tell you that it's very, very hard to decipher accents and words to actually understand you. And Speechmatics has created a new platform from the ground up that plans to take automatic speech recognition further forward in how we interact with machines and with each other.
And John, the whole concept of humans speaking to devices and the device responding is, for my generation, and you and I are roughly the same generation, still a rather strange feeling. But have you got used to the idea? Do you speak to a device across the room, tell it to play the music or put the kettle on or anything?
Of course, being in the mobile phone industry, I've been at the forefront of technology, but it's never been technology for technology's sake. For me, technology has to make a quantum leap forward. And one of the biggest inhibitors of technology, and still is today, is man-user interfaces. It's how to get the person to understand how to control the device. If you could control it truly and properly by speech, which doesn't work today, it does work to an extent, of course, but it's not very good. It's very faulty. You can sometimes have to repeat yourself 10 times. If you could get a device that will truly understand your accent and sometimes your slang words and so on, and actually, I can't imagine how that could work. But if this does truly work, then I really think that could be very, very big for that company. I don't know that it disrupts very much. It just becomes a replacement for the others. And what it would disrupt is all their competitors, because if this is a speech platform as good as is being said, then it should knock everybody else out, because that's what we all want. We all want the device that works. And when we say, I want Channel 4 and I want to watch Planet Earth, we want it to be that, not some porn channel or something, you know, something that we didn't want to watch. So I think this has really got huge potential on a global scale, and especially because I read that it's got the ability to learn different languages. And I can't imagine that either. I'm sure there must be some flaws in this, but if not, this will really be big, and they'll undoubtedly grow a phenomenal business out of this.
So what we have to decide about this particular entrant, Speechmatics, is whether it's a small step forward in its field of technology or it's a really big and groundbreaking one. But it's an area of science that's clearly going to enter everybody's lives over the next few years. I was, as it happens, at one of the very large banks the other day watching a presentation about how the 200 most frequently asked questions are now being put onto a kind of robotic program where a human face, a virtual human being, will appear on your screen or your phone. And when you say, do I qualify for a mortgage, it will ask you the relevant questions and tell you what you have to do next and so on. And that apparently on focus group tests with older customers are quite liking it, because rather than the maddening phone call centre experience and listening to the music, there is actually somebody, even if it's a robot, talking to them. But can you see in your business speech recognition becoming an essential tool?
I can. I agree with John that it certainly appears to be fallible at the moment. But I can see in the future that in our industry, all telephone conversations and all meetings, in fact, will be transcribed for file notes. And I suspect that is not very far down the road.
And that's a compliance
To meet regulatory requirements and protect the customer as well. But that's certainly, I think, not far down the road. And this sort of technology, if reliable, will greatly assist and enable that.
Okay, well, let's turn to the third of our candidates today, which is Warwick Music Group, based in Tamworth, as I said. Mark, just a brief word about that.
Warwick Music Group has revolutionised the brass music industry by creating instruments that, not surprisingly, traditionally have been made out of brass, but creating instruments made out of plastic instead. More affordable, lightweight and robust than their traditional counterparts, schools and children across the world have made the P-bone, plastic trombone, the biggest selling trombone worldwide. And with other instruments as well, then it does seem as if it might be that these traditional brass instruments made out of plastic become capable of replacing the recorder as the starter instrument.